You're listening to Energy Insiders, a weekly update on clean energy and climate policy with Renew Economies editor Giles Parkinson and leading energy analyst David Leach. Energy Insiders is brought to you by Evergen, providing cutting-edge energy management software for battery optimization, virtual power plants and distributed energy resources. And Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy and its associated websites, the EV-focused of The Driven, One Step Off the Grid. Joining me as usual is ITK principal David Leach. David, I trust you are well and not buying electricity off the spot market this week.
No, I don't think so. In fact, I'd like to think I was selling some electricity to the spot market this week, Giles. You know, in the future, I think we're going to be talking a lot about hydrogen, and haven't we got a great guest this week?
Well, we do, yes. Well, look, we'll get back to the New South Wales electricity prices, Labor's gas strategy and Origin's hiring of a retiring National Party MP and other matters later on. But first, we're going to introduce our conversation with Paul Barrett, from the CEO of Hysata, which has been spun out of the University of Wollongong. Last year opened its factory, which is not yet doing very much, which is going to be building alkaline electrolyzers, and they've just landed what they describe as the biggest Series B fundraising for a clean tech company in Australia. So let's have a listen to Paul Barrett from Hysata. Paul Barrett, thank you very much for joining the Energy Insiders podcast.
I appreciate it. Great to be here.
Well, it's a big day for Hysata, the hydrogen electrolyzer technology company that you lead. You guys have landed what I think you've described as the biggest ever cleantech Series B financing in Australian history. I think 172 million Australian. You've attracted some very big name players internationally, BP, the Oman Investment Fund, POSCO, a whole bunch of others. It seems to be quite remarkable given that there's been a lot of market skepticism, I guess, about electrolyzer technology and the woes that have come have faced, at least in the share price, of competitors such as Plug Power and Bloom Energy. I can't remember what my question is now. It's basically, what a remarkable achievement. How did you do it?
Well, why don't I kick off firstly, and I think the conversation will flow. So great to be here, and sort of humbled and honored to represent Team Hysata as we announce this, you know, significant Series B round. And this has been the culmination of, you know, many years' work. It's really validating of our technology. It's really validating of the commercial progress we're making. And it's really credit to Team Hysata. We've built an incredible team and culture here at Hysata and continue to over-execute on our march to getting this product to market.
Yeah. Well, tell us exactly about the technology. I mean, I had the good fortune of visiting your new premises in Wollongong when you opened it last August. What makes your technology different? Because you're talking about sort of it's more high efficiency, or it's got better efficiency than other competing technologies. Can you just sort of dig into that, exactly what that efficiency improvement is and how you've achieved it?
Yeah, so at the headline is that we have a really giant leap in efficiency performance. So we operate at 95% system efficiency, which is 41.5 kilowatt hours per kilogram. And a typical incumbent electrolyzer will be 52.5 kilowatt hours per kilogram or more. That's about a 20% saving. So that's a really giant leap in performance in an industry that's only really had incremental performance improvements over the last number of decades. So this kind of puts us head and shoulders above the competition in terms of efficiency. And efficiency is super important because when you look at the levelized cost of green hydrogen, the price of power, the energy that you put into the electrolyzers, really dominates. And when you have a 20% saving on that price of power, it sort of profoundly redefines the economics of green hydrogen. Mm. And then at the core of our technology, it's, you know, a really simple and elegant invention that we've really built incredible engineering and manufacturing capability around. So this tech, and you may recall when we spoke previously, is that it was developed at the University of Wollongong in the lab of Professor Jerry Swiggers. And Jerry had that, in hindsight, very right to left kind of thinking, was holistic in looking at the problems with existing electrolyzers. And the problem with existing electrolyzers is they're inefficient. And the root cause of that inefficiency is a membrane that sticks between or stays between the two electrodes. So in an electrolyzer, one electrode makes oxygen when it splits water, and the other electrode makes hydrogen when it splits water. And you need a membrane between them to stop the hydrogen and oxygen mixing. The membrane in a traditional electrolyzer is essentially an air gap. It stops the gases from mixing. But it's not very electrically conductive, so it's a resistor. And if you pass electrons or electricity through a resistor, you generate heat, which is kind of wasting your electrons. So not all the energy you're putting in is splitting the water. It's going into, or some of it's going into heat. And in incumbent systems, it's over 25% heat generation. And that has a few knock-on effects to the balance of system. So you need to cool and so on. What Hysata has done is replace that existing membrane with actually an off-the-shelf air filtration membrane that acts like a sponge. So it's a very thin membrane, off-the-shelf, so easy to manufacture, a really low cost. And just like a sponge at home that you stick in the sink or use a paper towel to mop up your spilled bit of water, sponges will, through what they call capillary force, because they're porous, will suck water into that membrane. So we have targeted delivery of liquid between our two electrodes. So that membrane in an existing or incumbent electrolyzer that was a resistor is now really conductive. So we've taken the resistance down of the cell 5 to 10x by making that change. And we've got another effect that is, is really big impact. And this is counterintuitive, right? So we're making hydrogen and oxygen gases, but we're doing it in bubble-free operation. In a typical electrolyzer, your electrodes are surrounded by liquid, and then the gases form at those electrode surface and form gas bubbles. And those then gas bubbles rise up through buoyancy and escape from your cell. Our system, because we've got that membrane with a very thin layer of liquid between the two electrodes, we got targeted delivery of that liquid, and then we get gases formed at a very thin film between the membrane and the electrodes, which enable the gases, not as gas bubbles, because there's no liquid, to escape as gas. And so that bubble-free formation also saves you energy. And I've got a really good analogy, and then I'll pause because I realize I'm probably talking too much. If you dial back to being a kid and you were blowing up a balloon or blowing into a milkshake, your cheeks would have got sore. That's because it takes energy to form bubbles. And we've eliminated that energy penalty with bubble formation, coupled with collapsing the resistance in the cell. And net-net, we have this really fundamental shift in the performance of an electrolyzer.
Look, I can tell you that those sore cheeks still happen when as an adult. You've improved the efficiency. What about the actual cost of the technology then? Have you actually managed to, are you competitive on costs? Have you reduced the costs of the electrolyzer itself?
And cost is a good question. And when you look at an electrolyzer, you really need to look at the levelized cost of green hydrogen, which is a blend of the CapEx, or the capital cost of your equipment, coupled with the OpEx, which is dominated by, as I mentioned earlier, the electricity costs. So we have a huge win on the electricity cost because we use less. And then we have an intrinsically low CapEx. Our bill of materials, we're using earth-abundant materials like steel and nickel. And our balance of plant is simplified because we have such high efficiency. We have way less cooling. In fact, an order of magnitude less cooling. And that slashes the, consider like a house with an air conditioner. And now we only need to put in an air conditioner that's 10 times smaller. So the CapEx is smaller and the running cost of that cooling system is smaller. So a really simplified system. So we're having a profound impact on the cost.
So, Paul, I've got a lot of questions, but why don't we just start with what the goals are for the next year or two? Because, I mean, what's the biggest scale electrolyzer? What's your biggest one that you actually got in your facility there at Wollongong?
Yeah, so the plan after raising this Series B with that world-leading list of investors that we should get into in this conversation again is to essentially continue on our scale-up journey. So we have 75 people at the moment, 34% female, 85% of the team is engineers. So this is we're building a physical product with a lot of really wonderful engineers. Yeah.
But the electrolyzer, how big is it?
Yeah, so we're testing commercial scale systems in our facility today. And we've got a number of field trials upcoming with customers later this year and into next year.
And what's commercial scale mean?
Yeah, we've got a highly modular system. And I can't disclose, because a lot of it's confidential, the dimensions of physical size, but we've got commercial scale units now, highly modular. So think like a solar panel. So what solar panels...
Can we talk about the input power? What's the input power of your biggest existing system or one, and how do you plan to scale that up?
Yeah, as I mentioned, we're making commercial scale systems today.
So 1 megawatt?
So we're making commercial scale systems. You're doing a great job with the interview. I'm not going to disclose the physical scale because it's confidential. It's a competitive environment that I don't disclose some of our trade secrets, but rest assured we're working on commercial scale systems, and that's really enabled us to bring home this investment round with a blend of world-leading financial investors coupled with move the needle strategics. And these strategics, when you look at the strategics we've brought in,
let's not look at the strategics because I guess we wouldn't be having this discussion if we didn't know that you had some great investors on board. And in fact, I see that talking to the board and the advisory council, you've got some real names there like Alan Finkel and Michael Liebrich. Now, Michael Liebrich's kind of his hydrogen ladder is, I think, something that Giles and I have looked at a lot. And where do you see the use case for hydrogen?
Yeah, well, it does interrelate to the strategic investors. So if you've read our material before or listened to some of my narrative from previous interviews, Hysata were highly targeted at bringing a product to market aimed at those hard-to-abate sectors. So these are the sectors that are hard or impossible to electrify. So this is a steel manufacturer, chemical manufacturer, high-grade industrial heat, and building blocks to make sustainable aviation fuels and fuels for shipping on sea.
So none of those are the existing 100 million tons of hydrogen demand around the world in
Oh, they absolutely are, right? So if you look at chemical manufacture, ammonia and methanol is the backbone of the existing natural gas derived hydrogen industry. So huge opportunity to deeply decarbonize those sectors, and frankly it's the only way to decarbonize those. And then ammonia is a really interesting one as a potential energy vector for export. So clearly making ammonia for fertilizer is goal number one, but it can also be used as a vector to export renewable energy. It's very difficult to move electrons across continents. It's very difficult to liquefy and transport hydrogen. So energy carriers like ammonia and methanol are definitely on the horizon for Australia and other jurisdictions around the world.
They sure are, but you have to converting the ammonia back into hydrogen at the other end is very expensive, I think.
No,
go on, sorry.
You're asking questions and you don't quite have all the facts. So I'm happy to help in this conversation and talk about it. This is an important point, and there's really big misconceptions out there. So ammonia is, it's about 100 million tons of or $100 billion worth of ammonia traded and shipped around the world today. It's the backbone. Our bodies have 70% nitrogen derived from Haber-Bosch ammonia. So it's actually a vital chemical process that's underscored food production for the last 100 years.
Sure, but is that hydrogen, is that ammonia, sorry, converted back into hydrogen at the other end?
It depends on the use case, right? So you can export ammonia for fertilizer usage. You can export it for co-firing in power plants. It really depends on the use case, right? And the use case is driven by the offtake and what those customers want to do. So there's multiple use cases for ammonia. So don't just think you have to convert it back to hydrogen.
No, I don't. But that was the actual question I asked, if you were going to use it in, say, power production. Not to matter. I didn't mean to be too difficult. It interests me. So if we were just to come back to your targets for the next year or two, maybe you could just talk about the roadmap from here.
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, we got this wonderful team, 75 people. So there's probably several things we're doing with this capital is, you know, building the team and getting the materials and equipment to build our first manufacturing line. And that manufacturing line will furnish the units for our commercial scale field trials and ultimately full commercialization. And we've had mass manufacturing in mind since time zero. And I've got an incredible chief engineering officer who's PhD Stanford, worked 30 years in high-tech manufacturing and has shipped over $100 billion worth of product in his career. And he brings a shipping mentality. This is a company that has a shipping product mentality. So while it's worth celebrating a big milestone like a Series B, victory here is product at the door and customers buying our product. So everything we've done in the product architecture and product design has really had on one side maintaining and enhancing that efficiency, but also keeping mass manufacturing in mind. And so we've got this wonderful facility down in Wollongong, Giles, that you saw last year that we've now got largely fit out. We've ordered a bunch of manufacturing equipment. And in fact, I've got a piece of equipment getting delivered from Europe next quarter that will do over a gigawatt per annum of our membrane electrode assembly. So we've got really great flex capacity in our manufacturing approach and in the equipment we're procuring.
So when do you actually expect manufacturing and sort of delivering, whatever the final commercial product is to your first customers? Is that like 1 year, 2 years, 3 years away?
Yeah, those kind of time horizons. So we've got a development manufacturing line at the moment, and you consider that being leveraging all the tools and unit operations that a full manufacturing line would use, but in more kind of manual operation. And we're gradually increasing the scale and machine assisted nature of the unit operations across that manufacturing line.
Okay. Yeah. It's interesting because Australia now has two, you guys are not manufacturing yet, but you've got that facility and you obviously intend to, and you've got this sort of fantastic backing from some of these really big players, and you've got Fortescue up in Gladstone, and it's got its own production facility and its own electrolyzer technology. That's a PEM technology, which is different to your alkaline technology. Is there kind of like a collegiate atmosphere between these sort of two competitors? I mean, judging by your sort of hesitancy to sort of talk about the sort of the size of your modules, it sounds like it's pretty cutthroat out there.
Oh, well, this is the business world. You know, I'm really focused on what Hysata is doing and our differentiation. And, you know, there's really a great hydrogen community building out there, not just in Australia and across the world. And I think I draw parallels from the solar industry, right? So if we look at solar panels today, wonderful technology, super low cost, high quality, and really driving down, the dollar per megawatt hour of renewables, of renewable electricity, and absolutely incredible, and it's not stopping, right? But if you dial back 10, 15 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer than that, it was really a huge consolidation in that industry. And the majority of the world's solar panels are now made in China, right? High quality, low cost panels. The only really Western OEM that survived and thrived that consolidation was First Solar. And First Solar, you're probably familiar as a thin film cadmium telluride solar panel. And the reason they survived is they were highly differentiated. And you've probably heard the expression, you got to be paranoid to survive, but in a world where there can be consolidation, you got to be differentiated to survive. And we've got this high differentiation that gives us the ability to really give performance and cost leadership in this industry and be well positioned to get major market share.
And presumably you'll be taking a great interest in the Made in Australia, the details of the Made in Australia program that's been sort of flagged by the federal government.
It's a really great expression and one that I use around here at Australia. And I think we really are a good example of a future made in Australia. This was an Australian invented technology. All the engineering's been done here in Australia. We're doing the manufacturing in Australia and we're getting global traction, like really global traction, not just through investment, but the capacity reservation agreements we're signing with our global blue chip companies. So I'm keen to continue to work with all levels of government to ensure we anchor companies like Hesada in Australia, you know, doing what we can do, you know, creating Australian jobs and exporting technology to the world. And I have one quick anecdote for you. I mentioned we have Vestas as one of our shareholders. Vestas are the world's biggest wind turbine company, headquartered in Aarhus, which is in Western Denmark. And I, actually the town, which I've been to a couple of times, is about the same size as the city of Wollongong. And so there's no reason I see that we can't emulate them and become the world leading electrolyzer company headquartered in Wollongong, but having global operations.
Well, look, we wish you good luck with that. Look, there's lots and lots of other questions that we'd like to ask you, particularly about, I guess, what Vestas and people like BlueScope want to do with your product. But I guess the we'll have to wait for another time. Paul, look, thank you very much for your time today and congratulations on your fundraising and all the best for the next phase of development.
Yeah, much appreciated. Nice to chat today and we'll chat again soon, I'm sure.
Good on you. Thank you very much, Paul.
Cheers.
Energy Insiders is brought to you by Nextracker, delivering some of the highest performing solar assets in the country. With local manufacturing right here in Australia, Nextracker's market-leading solar solutions deliver optimal return on investment and superior extreme weather resilience for utility solar farms in Australia. Check out their flagship NX Horizon Smart Solar Tracker, their intelligent optimization software, and the industry's most advanced terrain following solar tracking technology, NX Horizon XTR.
That was Paul Barrett from Hysata. David, look, interesting stuff. I mean, fantastic getting that money from the big investors. We had a interesting chat off the mic afterwards. Don't know how much we can share of that, but it was interesting, just sort of, you know, the cutthroat nature of the hydrogen industry and the need to sort of focus on very, you know, sort of discrete parts of the industry. But he seems fairly confident that there's great demand out there. It'll be interesting to see to what extent these Australian technologies can withstand the onslaught of China.
As you know, Giles, I always said that the made in Australia or installed in Australia strategy doesn't really take account of the fact that manufacturing these days is a partnership of things done at different stages, where design can take place, R&D in one country, the assembly in another country, the marketing can be done in a third country, and the advertising, the actual sales can take place all over the world. We do live in a global village, although, you know, international relations are trying to make that as hard as possible. And the fact is that we have a number of great inventions in Australia, and I think money spent on the R&D side of things gives us the highest return on investment. And that's what I would wish that the federal government was putting more money into university funding and that sort of thing, than necessarily into building robot-style factories.
Well, maybe what happens is that we put the market into R&D, we develop the electrolyzers, which clearly Hysata are doing. We have some sort of manufacturing capacity in Australia, and then we find some smart way of licensing this to be maybe produced somewhere else if it ends up being cheaper there. But we don't kind of just sort of throw it away as we might have done in the past.
Well, we'll have to just see. Certainly Australia's population now at 25 million is more capable of supporting a bigger manufacturing base. But ultimately, if you... anyway, there's a lot of different... It's a very complicated subject when all is said and done. It is great to see that electrolyzer energy input is coming down and can go from 50 kilowatt hours per kilogram of hydrogen down to 40. I note that RMI, who produced a big report on the cost of hydrogen, actually used 44 as their kind of baseline number. So some kind of progress is certainly forecast to happen by some of the big consultants out there.
Yeah, no, well, it's actually interesting to note that Hysata does compare their efficiency gains to what they call incumbent technologies, but there's a fair few other developers out there at the same stage of them who are also sort of claiming equal numbers in efficiency. So whoever sort of kind of wins the race is going to be interesting. And as you sort of said to us in the conversation after us, it kind of looks a lot like the solar industry in the early stages of the solar industry. And of course, there's lots of, you know, cleaning out and stuff.
There's a lot to think about too from Australia's perspective as we've explored over the past 2 or 3 or 4 years. Michael Liebrich, who is on the... Is it Liebrich or Liebrich? How do you pronounce it?
Oh, I'm not too sure.
He pointed out that the cost of transporting hydrogen is enormous, really. Like about... It would basically add 4 times to the cost, the delivered cost somewhere on over a long distance. It's about 4 times if you ship it as pure hydrogen, due to its volumetric lightness and the fact that it's a colder temperature, so you've got to boil it off, you lose more on the voyage. And if you get into the ammonia market, that's easy enough. But if you want to then actually use you can't use ammonia, as far as I know, to actually make the steel. You've got to use the hydrogen as hydrogen. And so then you've got to convert the ammonia back into hydrogen, as I was trying to talk about. I mean, it's a long, complicated story. And as to where the hydrogen's actually made in Australia is actually going to go get used. And if you think you're going to make green steel in Australia, I think it's ambitious just yet. I mean,
You certainly don't want to be making green hydrogen at the sort of wholesale power prices we saw in New South Wales this week, where, we had 3 coal units tripped, 2 at Eraring, we had 1 at Vales Point, we had transmission issues which sort of restricted the output of places like Bayswater, so we had about 3 gigawatts of coal-fired power missing, and the energy market, as normal, just couldn't help themselves. They pushed the price to the market cap so often over a 24-hour period that the accumulative price cap was breached and a administrative price cap was introduced. David, this is not a very good look for the market. We don't really have much faith, or many consumers.
It's wonderful, Giles.
I thought you might say that, actually, but there you go, because it's an incentive to build more stuff, I presume.
It is. It is a wonderful incentive. And there's just not enough batteries at the moment on the one hand, but more importantly, there's not enough wind and solar being built. New South Wales is still not getting on with it anywhere near fast enough. We did see another wind farm approved in New England this year, which brings me...
This week.
So that's 2 in New South Wales, in the first quarter, more or less. First half anyway, that's exciting. And it was in New England. Now, I feel myself, and I wrote a big piece about this that I'm quite proud of, that really we should try harder, and the renewable production may well move to the Riverina. But at the moment, the plan is to build a lot in New England. And I think Origin Energy's done a very clever thing in hiring the National Party member for New England at the state level, Adam Marshall, into their public relations, because, we all know psychologically that having someone from inside the tent say something is a good idea is way better than having 100 people outside the tent telling you you need to do something.
Yeah, no, well, that's right. I mean, Adam Marshall is one of these people who we sort of stand and talk to and wonder what the heck they're doing in the National Party, given some of the policies that has been sprouted around at the moment. And their sort of federal leadership is sort of saying they want to stop wind and solar farms, but I'm not too sure that Adam agrees with that. So it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out, because Origin's made some pretty big bets in New England, or at least in terms of sort of buying properties and buying projects from Walcher Energy.
Walker.
God, we're going to get our pronunciation right. Oh,
yeah,
dear.
Next you'll be pronouncing Thunderbolt, the bushranger, wrong. But I'll forgive you.
That was the Thunderbolt wind farm that was actually approved by the Independent Planning Commission this week, following Bowman's
Creek.
Brings
me to, we don't talk about politics very much on this podcast.
Well, that's because you don't like to.
But I will observe that the state National Party, the state Liberal parties, often seem to be at odds with the federal party. I think you noted, and it's been widely noted, that in Queensland at the moment, that they're reluctant to embrace the federal nuclear strategy. And, the Barnaby Joyce style of going about things is not embraced in New South Wales, where the national New South Wales sided with the Liberal Party and the Labor Party to get the New South Wales plan up and running. So, you know, politics is a strange thing, isn't it, really? And maybe we would be better off talking politics at the federal level. They've come up with a gas strategy. Can you call it a strategy?
Well, I'm not really too sure what it is. It just sends all the wrong signals. It just seems to be, yes, we're not going to do much to stop you. We're going to encourage you. A pretty disappointing thing, really. And I we've talked quite often to Chris Bowen on this podcast. And look, I think he's terrific. I think he's doing a fine job. But one of the things I've sort of said over the years, or since Labor came to power, is that as good as Chris Bowen is, he's sort of up against what you might describe as the Labor machine, and the Labor machine is just not prepared to go as far as say Mr. Bowen wants to go across the whole economy. I mean, he's been given license to sort of do as best he can in the grid in terms of renewables and the capacity investment scheme, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the whole economic transition, and this is where the sort of the gas strategy comes in, it just seems to be more like a bit of a capitulation, as I think as people describe it, and particularly disappointing coming at the same time as, you know, we've got an update from the climate scientists just on the sort of, you know, the tragedy that we're facing with the climate crisis. And it's just a really bad look, and probably in many people's mind a good reason as any to sort of hope for maybe a minority Labor government at the next poll, just to have the Greens and the Teals having more influence in the same way as the Greens and the Independents had influence over the Gillard government more than a decade ago, and came up with some fantastic policies and some institutions which have stood the test of time, such as the CEFC and ARENA. And still ripping away here. It was just interesting that Gillard was appointed as chair of a new energy transition fund to be created by HMC Capital. So, interesting stuff.
That's an initial $2 billion there, run by some people that I used to work with, Dave DePilla, and at the head level, and Angela Carl, who's got a great record at QIC previously and helped with Tilt a lot. I guess the point of it's Madeleine King, I think, that's had a lot to do with it in West Australia, where a lot of the future gas is going to be developed. But the interesting thing in that riff you had, Giles, was about the climate change. And I think you'll be aware that there's a reasonable amount, there's a theory that climate change is actually accelerating. For reasons that removing aerosols, for instance, is from the atmosphere. I don't want to get into it too much, but I think we do need to talk about it. And there's evidence that, in fact, things are getting worse faster. And therefore, the time available in the carbon budget to avoid these kind of things is less. But I don't think you and I talking about it on the podcast is going to change the way the Labor Party right wing thinks about it. And I would agree with you that I think, and I said it to Chris Bowen, I think that actually he has done more in his couple of years there than was done in the previous decade, and done it with less fuss. And so anyway, I'm not sure what else we can say about that.
Well, he's consulted and he's worked constructively with the state governments. That's what he's done. When you sort of see it in that sort of prism, it's not actually that hard to do. But just on climate change, I just observe that I think what we don't know and what the climate scientists fear is the heat that has been absorbed by the oceans. And I heard a remarkable study that every day in the last year has been a new record for the heat stored in the oceans, and I think that's what's going to come back. And
the front page, Giles, of my own website has and will always have that. You know, at the moment, the amount of ocean heat, the energy going into ocean heat each year, is 30 times the value of all the coal, the energy in all the coal, oil, and gas that is produced each year. 30 times, and it is accelerating. And so you can think of it in one sense as a huge giant battery we're charging up quite quickly, and it's going to start giving it back to us in the form of heat, and it already is.
Well, on that cheerful note, it's probably time to sort of wind up the podcast for this week. Look, it's been great talking to Paul Barrett from Hysata. Thank you, David.
Giles, one other thing I think that we need to mention, it's electric vehicles, which I'd like to talk more about. But in fact, in Australia, we're going through a disaster stage of in the charging network, aren't we? With tritium, no one even sure who's going to be looking after it. The NRMA, which has done an incredibly good job at building a charging network, I've used their chargers many times in regional New South Wales, has had some battery-charged chargers, sort of company go fut underneath them. And then your good mate Tesla has kind of fired the entire charging team at the biggest charger, which is a company that probably owns the most chargers in all the world. Can you? What's going on there?
No one has a bloody clue what's going on there at Tesla. People are sort of guessing and second guessing and triple guessing what might be happening. I think that's yet to be seen. What we're definitely seeing, I think, is probably, look, from the auto industry point of view, I think there's a general concession now, particularly with the US automakers, that they can't beat the Chinese at this game. And so they're probably going to sort of focus on the sort of the top end and the luxury end and focus on other parts of the auto industry. For Tesla, that means subscriptions, it means energy storage, it means robo-taxis and AI and all that other sort of stuff. On the charging networks, yes, tritium, we're still yet to see exactly why that went belly up. It looks like it wasn't particularly well managed, looked like they had major reliability issues. Another company looks like it's gone belly up in the US called FreeWire. NRMA, as you mentioned, had two of their machines installed in Mittagong, which sounded great because they basically had integrated battery. One of the problems with some of the super fast charging in Australia is that some of those things don't actually work at their rated capacity because the local networks won't allow them to, because they say, no, you can't do that. There's not enough grid support for you. By having an integrated battery, you can sort of power people at the speeds that they want to be powered at. But look, it looks like there were some technical problems there. The fact that this company's got some financial issues, and it looks like NRMA's decided to cut its losses, take them out and replace them. So good on them for doing that, actually.
You mentioned the Chinese companies. The Beijing Auto Show, I think, was on in the last few days, and no doubt that's been mentioned anywhere, but I was fascinated to read about the Xiaomi, if I've pronounced that right, SU7, which is an incredibly good-looking car to my eye. You know, has a 70 to 100 kilowatt hour battery and is supposed to cost 30,000 euros. That's what I call real competition for everyone else. I mean, it's probably as good as an electric Porsche at about, you know, a third of the price.
Well, that's right. And I think that's what the Chinese manufacturers are doing, is that they're showing that they can make sub $50,000 cars, which are really, really electric cars, which are really, really attractive. And you're just looking at the latest releases from some of the European manufacturers and even the Japanese ones, and they struggle to produce anything at a cost of 60 or 70,000. Some of them don't even have much in terms of range. They just seem to be copies of their existing petrol things and really attractive to very few people. So yeah, I just think the Chinese absolutely nailed it. And I think some of the other incumbent manufacturers are going to have to rethink their strategy. And clearly in the US with GM and Ford, which is losing $130,000, $200,000 Australian for every car they've made in the last quarter, they're going to be rethinking how much money they're going to throw at this.
This is a standard incumbent versus disruption strategy and raises the broader question, which I won't get into because our listeners won't thank me for doing it, about what is our relationship with China. Do we want cheap goods? Because we're not going to be making those cheap electric cars here in Australia, no matter what anyone thinks. Or is there some other way that we're going to go? And as you know, in cars, Australia is very heavily tied to Japan. Through Toyota and companies like that. And whereas I like South Korean cars that have done a great job, but I think in the future, China cars could be a great liberator for Australia. But that's my own personal view, no matter what I might think about politics. But hey, it's probably time to thank our sponsors on that note.
And also acknowledge some of our other podcasts. And Elena over at the Switched On podcast has got a great interview with Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute, which you talked about, I think, earlier on. He's one of the sort of the founding fathers of the energy efficiency. Got into this game half a decade ago. He's coming out to Australia in a couple of weeks, or next week, I think, and really good interview. Sophie has got a great interview with the people sort of helping households get off gas on the Solar Insiders podcast. And we, of course, will be back next week with another episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, Pylon, Evergen, and Nextracker, who have joined us, which is great. And welcome aboard. And that's it for now. Goodbye.
Energy Insiders was brought to you by Evergen, the market-leading renewable energy software business that optimises residential and commercial solar and battery systems. Evergen enables large numbers of systems to operate as a single fleet, so network operators can use them as a virtual power plant, generating significant value for consumers, network operators, and the energy system as a whole. Evergen software is powering the energy system of the future. Energy Insiders was also brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly cost, and no locking contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.